Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A home of one's own is the great American dream, and for all intents and purposes, it took as much root in the world of enslaved African American people as anyone who has conceived of that dream. And yet, history has shown us that African Americans, especially women, who embrace the values of home life and who have felt a sense of belonging here despite their origins and who achieve their modification of the American dream, also often attract the animus of racists. The more they achieve, the more the animus. We're talking about this dynamic today. My guest is Ohio State University Associate Professor and Literary Historian Caritha Mitchell. She is the author of the 2012 book, Living with Lynching, African-American Lynching Plays, Performance, and Citizenship, 1819 to 1930. Her new book, published in August, is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African American Culture. Welcome back, Caritha Mitchell.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I think the phrase that catches my attention first when I pick up the book is that of homemade citizenship. And I wanted you to talk about that for a while and explain what you mean and how you came to that concept.
Sure. Homemade citizenship is a deep sense of success and belonging that does not rely on civic inclusion. Homemade citizenship is something that develops because of the community that African Americans create among themselves. And part of what I argue is that community conversation is how they cultivate that community and cohere as a community. It's not really that identity makes us a community. It's that we're constantly in conversation. And so homemade citizenship is a way to understand that debate is always part of that conversation, that part of the way I know I'm part of the community is that I'm willing to debate other members of the community about everything, including how we know that we've been successful. And so there's never agreement about that, especially in a society like the United States that punishes you for every variation of success that you have. And so there's debate about, okay, are we successful, let's say in the slavery era, are we successful because we're able to survive, or may we be more successful if we don't survive and don't allow enslavers to be enriched by our life and labor? So it's been about a debate from the very beginning.
Exactly, from the very beginning. And you refer to literature across the 400 years to do this. Tell us about the volumes you tapped for your insights. Give us this kind of a thumbnail of the variety of literature that you use to come to the conclusions and to make your points in this book.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. So I begin with Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, which was published in 1861, right before the Civil War. And in that same chapter, I look at Elizabeth Keckley's Behind the Scenes, or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House. So you can see in that one chapter, we move from slave cabins to the White House because Keckley is acknowledging the fact that she was the dressmaker to Abraham Lincoln's wife. In the next chapter, I look at Frances Harper's Iola Leroy, which was published in 1892, and Pauline Hawkins' Contending Forces, published in 1900. So in that chapter, we're really looking at the 1890s and early 1900s, because that is a moment of the Black domestic novel and this real investment in thinking about love stories and home and the creation of home in the 1890s. And part of what's powerful about that is those texts are deliberately looking both at slavery and the post-emancipation era. And part of what you find there is, as you're defining success and debating success, part of what you see is that they want to acknowledge that Black love is the thing that remains the same, both in slavery and after emancipation. And they basically are debating about how can we make sure that Black love isn't used as a tool against us as it was in slavery? The main thing that made people vulnerable was that they loved each other. So how do we use Black love as something that can empower us as we march into this future. And part of what those novels show is the way that there is a real debate about that. So I guess part of what I should say, you know, as you're allowing me to trace this out, is that that first chapter is looking at woman-authored slave narratives. And then that second chapter is looking at fiction. And so part of what I'm showing you is the way that, you know, developing homemade citizenship is something that you'll see almost regardless of the genre. In the next chapter, chapter three, I'm looking at Quicksand by Nella Larson and Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. So those dates are 1928 and 1937. And part of what's interesting there is that as we enter into this new Negro era, right, what most people would call a Harlem Renaissance, mm-hmm. what we find that I thought was amazing, because of course the book's point is to say, if I trace success and how people are redefining their definition of success in Black communities, then we will see things we didn't see before. And part of what I'm able to see when we start looking at the new Negro era is the way that the community conversation is starting to define success by using the male worker as its gauge for success. In that earlier chapter, we were actually using the Black mother as our gauge for whether we were successful or not. So part of the change that you see is having women take a backseat to Black men and boys and defining success as the community in the form of the Black male worker. And so I trace the way that that shifts. Should I continue?
Yeah, I just want to let listeners know who you are again, if you're just joining us. My guest is Caritha Mitchell. She's a literary historian, a cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. And her new book is what we're talking about. It's titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African-American Culture. It was published in August. If you have a question or a comment coming up in the program, I certainly welcome that. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And right now, Caritha Mitchell is sort of giving us a thumbnail of the literature that she used to make the point of her book. And go ahead, Caritha.
Excellent. Thank you. So I'm up to chapter four, where I look at Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun and Alice Childress's Wine in the Wilderness. And part of what's important about that chapter is where we step into drama as our example. So we had slave narratives, fiction, and now drama. And of course, part of what I do in this chapter is Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun is known as a civil rights drama. And I show how Black people are defining their success in terms of the home as a human right, but then juxtaposing that with Alice Childress's A Wine in the Wilderness, because she's showing us how they're defining home as a source of Black power and self-determination. And that play is identified with the Black power movement. So here you have, we assume, civil rights as integration and Black power as separatism. But what I'm showing is the debate within the community conversation, again, about how do you define success. Chapter five, still the master's house with a question mark, is looking at Kindred by Octavia Butler, 1979, and Beloved, 1987, by Toni Morrison. And the reason that becomes so important is because these are texts in the 70s and 80s that look back to the slavery era. And part of what I show is that those texts are entering into a community conversation about Black success that in some ways is responding to the success of Alex Haley's Roots as both a text and as a television series. And this is a moment where, again, we're getting this idea that the way to define success is through that strong male head of household, and women really need to think about taking a back seat. And it seems to me that what Octavia Butler and Toni Morrison do is they say, if we're going to examine how slavery continues to have an impact, right, the argument with Haley's roots is sort of this idea that because Black men are not allowed to be the heads of household that they were supposed to be, and slavery distorted that, we need to get back to something that is closer to that. And I think that Butler and Morrison are saying, well, if slavery continues to have pressure on our current current domestic configurations, and we believe it does, let's think more complexly about how it has that impact. And let's look back at the slavery era with an eye toward what Black women experienced in slavery, not just what Black men experienced. And then the last chapter, chapter 6, I call it The Ultimate Home, Michelle Obama in the White House. And there, I'm continuing this exploration by saying, okay, let's look at Michelle Obama's first lady persona as a performance text. Let's take seriously how she constructs that persona. Decisions about hair, decisions about clothes, bodily presentation, and her decisions about how to decorate the White House as she continues the tradition that Jacqueline Kennedy started with borrowing artwork that would, you know, be her signature about how to decorate the White House. So I look at all of those decisions as part of creating the performance text of her persona as First Lady, and take those decisions seriously. And then, of course, in the coda, I call that from mom in chief, which is what Michelle Obama called herself, from mom in chief to predator in chief. And I look seriously at 63 million voters' decision to move the country from having a mom in chief to having a predator in chief in the person of someone who bragged about grabbing women by their privates.
You said in the introduction of your book that you have lived with this project for several years. And obviously, it's your stock and trade. It's what you do. You're a literary historian, and you're African-American, and, you know, all that makes sense. But I'm wondering what sparked it for you?
Thank you. Yes. Well, in all honesty, it was what I learned from writing my first book, Living with Lynching, that you mentioned. The most powerful lesson I learned from doing the research and writing of Living with Lynching was that you were not targeted by the mob because you were a criminal. Most likely you were targeted because you were successful in some way and white people wanted to put you back in your proper place. So you had land that white people wanted to take. You had the audacity to negotiate for a fair price for your crop. Well, you don't know your proper place. Let me put you back in your proper place. And of course the mob targets you not only to put you in your proper place, but to terrorize your family and your entire community. So all of them know, stay in your place. And so because that was the biggest lesson I learned from writing Living with Lynching, I thought to myself, not only is that clear, but it's also clear from these texts that Black people knew that they were more likely to be targeted because they were successful.
And yet they still pursued. They still were ambitious. They still went ahead. You talk about courage, right?
Exactly, because that is what I'm tracing is, it's not homemade citizenship if you don't acknowledge that your success is what gets you in trouble. Mm-hmm. If you really believe the lie that if you're perfect and behave like a perfect citizen, then you'll be safe. If you actually believe that, then that's not quite homemade citizenship. What you have to understand is how much American citizenship is actually geared toward keeping you in your so-called proper place.
And it's not, as far as the Black experience goes, it's not a given. It's something you have to work at. You made a point, I think I have it buried more in my questions, but how you can't just be a Black woman in America. You have to be a strong Black woman. You don't get the luxury of just being.
Yes. And, you know, okay. So
it kind of exhausted me to just think about that.
Yeah. And what I love about the way you're putting that toward me is that it helps me to think about, you know, part of what understanding how Know Your Place aggression works part of what it does is it makes you recognize how an objective standard of being, I don't know, hardworking, for example, that objective standard, as a matter of course, is not actually required of people who are considered white. That if you're white, you're considered a good and decent person, whether you do anything or not. And that is supposed to be, that is what defines being white in this country, because we created such a hierarchy. So your point is so well taken that I can't just be, because everything is set up to say that I am evil, I am disruptive, I am immoral. All of the things that the country says are bad things cling to me, literally, no matter what I'm doing. I can just be, I can be Michelle Obama. I can be Ivy League educated and all of this, but somehow those negative things just cling to me. I am assumed to be somehow anti-patriotic, anti-everything that's decent that we should hold up. It's important to think about the work of why is it that it takes so much that I've got to be a strong Black woman? And as you said, like part of what I do in the book is say, well, you've got this tradition of being a strong Black woman just to survive or just to be considered a citizen.
Literally.
Then Michelle Obama has to ratchet that up and become mom and chief.
Yeah, figuratively and literally. It's and figuratively meaning how she, as you put it, the performative piece of that. Let's take a quick break and continue our conversation. My guest is Caritha Mitchell. She's a literary historian, cultural critic, associate professor of English at Ohio State. Her new book, published in August, is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African-American Culture. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the trajectory of African-American achievement, particularly by that of African-American women as homemakers, has attracted so much attack from slave cabins to the White House. My guest is Ohio State University Associate Professor Caritha Mitchell. She is the author of the 2012 book Living with Lynching, African-American Lynching Plays, Performance, and Citizenship. Her new book is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African-American Culture. And Caritha Mitchell, thanks again for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
You wrote that African-American culture is best understood as a dynamic. And I'm wondering, how that differs from any culture.
Yeah, I say that it's best understood as a dynamic community conversation about success. And so what I mean by that is the way that it is similar to other cultures in terms of the dynamism, right?
Yeah.
That it's about words and deeds, gestures, demeanors. It's about all of the ways that human beings make meaning.
And how it changes over time.
Absolutely. And the way that we want to be alive to the many registers in which we can trace it, right? That it's not just the words, it's also gestures, movement, and so on.
You wrote that African Americans have continued to strive no matter how much they must adjust their conception of achievement. And that was brought out painfully but beautifully in chapter one, where you review the novelized autobiography by Harriet Jacobs that you mentioned, published in 1861. Talk about Harriet Jacobs and what we know about her. It was kind of painful to read about the progression of her expectations from a child to an adult, which started way too young.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess the first thing I should do is say that, you know, that is a perfect example of what I mean about how learning from Living with Lynching, how important success is as a lens. This project is really about reading through the lens of success rather than reading through the lens of protest. All of us are taught that marginalized communities are mostly reacting. They are reacting to the violence they encountered, to racism, they're protesting. And I was using this book as a way to say, if we read with an eye toward success and how people are defining and redefining and defining again success, we will see things that we wouldn't have seen otherwise.
So for example, in Harriet Jacobs' novelized autobiography, she has a cousin, Benjamin, who protests versus...
Yes, and part of... Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
And part of what's important... Oh, go ahead.
But that wasn't what you were focused on. You could have... But you took another route and looked at her successes and how that translated.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for this close read. Yes. So part of what's important is that we all have the tools to recognize and honor protests. So we will all notice what Benjamin is doing and understand how important it is. And Jacobs uses it to show just how deliberate and violent the entire system of slavery has to be in order to try to deny his humanity.
Yeah.
Right. Rodents and vermin attack him in the jail and all of that to break his will, and he still won't give up. And so he's clearly protesting, and any reader will notice that and notice the importance of it. And Jacobs notices it too. But I wanted to make sure that readers also had the tools they needed to acknowledge and trace success, the different ways that it gets defined and redefined, because even the smallest level of success draws attack. So to go to your point about how this, you know, the painful story I end up telling as I read Harriet Jacobs closely, is that you start out and you see how she, as you said, it's a novelized autobiography. And so she calls herself Linda Brent in the text. And so you start out and you see how Linda has this ideal about having a home in which she is a loved wife and mother. She, in her teenage years, falls in love with a free man of color, and they want to get married. And Dr. Flint, the person who owns her, basically says, if he comes around again, I would shoot him just like I would shoot a dog. And what I try to do in the chapter is make sure that we understand that the fact that she holds on to her humanity and agency is a victory, because she's in a country that tells her that she is not a human being with agency. She is a piece of property, and her will does not matter. So the fact that she holds on to her will enough to create intimacy, an affectionate connection with this free Black man, is a victory, and we need to acknowledge that. And part of how we know it's a victory is because it gets countered by Dr. Flint, who says, if he comes around again, I'll shoot him like a dog. And so after that point, you see this sharp turn where she is no longer defining her idea of domestic success in terms of being a wife and mother. She says, I'll never have that opportunity. But does she consign herself to failure?
Uh-huh.
No, she redefines success and basically makes it that I am going to choose the father of my children. That is my new definition of success.
Yes. And there is a kind of a foil in all of that. It is her aunt.
So she calls her Aunt Martha, and she's actually her grandmother.
Exactly. And she has achieved another kind of success.
Yes. And so part of what I'm interested in is the way that Aunt Martha she ends up being a way that we get to, if we're paying attention, mm-hmm. we get to see the debate. So
yeah.
Linda Brent and her older uncle, who is so close to age that they are like brother and sister, they debate about whether the success that Aunt Martha has is the success they should be able to have, because Aunt Martha says, I know that you want to be in the house with me and have a house like me, but being in Dr. Flint's house is what God wants for you right now. So just go ahead and do your best there. And so they debate among themselves and say, I don't know that I agree with her. but what we find, and I agree with you, it was painful for me to see too. What we find is that over time, Linda recognizes that all of her achievements are being countered to the point where now she is going to create the kind of home that is similar to Aunt Martha's, in that it is a home that is about family by blood, not family by choice. What we watch is how much Black women's agency in choosing romantic partners of their own is part of what enslavement is determined to obliterate. And so Jacobs, in the form of Linda Brent, basically has to pivot and say, okay, fine, now I'm going to define home in terms of this home that has blood relations, the children that I had, and never a partner of my choice. So yeah, it's a painful thing. But then the other thing that ends up being painful by the end is that at the end she says, reader, I have a home, but it's still not the home that I would want.
And that's part of her success, is being able to say that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, that's like, yeah, this isn't what I wanted, to be able to even utter that instead of playing an act or acting otherwise.
You're so right. And of course, part of what's powerful about recognizing that and honoring that is that part of what she does is leave this text for us, so that the community conversation I'm tracing is both the debate in the text, but it's also the way that it informs what generations afterward can understand.
Was she freed by the time she wrote this, or by the time it was published? I mean, what was her circumstances? Okay. Wow.
Yeah, so
I mean,
she was writing the book as she was working for the woman who had purchased her freedom. And as you said, part of what is powerful is her being able to say it, right?
Yeah.
Even in the text, she says, I had told her I didn't want her to purchase my freedom, that I preferred to go west. But she did it anyway. And so there's a balancing act where she talks about being grateful, but also that she doesn't like the society that made this even possible. Because part of what she makes so clear to us is that Aunt Martha, her grandmother, had tried to buy her many times, and American society made that impossible. Her father, before he died, wanted to free and purchase his children, but American society was set up that it wasn't just about being able to buy them, it was about keeping Black people in a proper place and thereby keeping them from even doing that.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack. Let's see. I want to get Henry here. Henry in Columbus, you're on the air with Professor Caritha Mitchell. Hi, Henry.
How you doing?
Good.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I had came in a little bit in the middle of the conversation you were having about Black people, I guess, who are successful. Are they seen as the norm in American society, or still more of an exception? And I just wanted some clarification on that, because I have this conversation a lot with friends of mine who are a little bit more conservative, who always feel like, well, if you just become more like American society and become successful, or let's say show your worth, basically you'll be accepted more.
I think it's really interesting, Henry, that you put it that way, show your worth, because that's a piece of what you're talking about, Caritha Mitchell, in the book, right?
Absolutely.
That whole idea of earning your salt, or whatever, worth your salt, you actually use that phrase in that.
Absolutely. I mean, part of what's important to understand is that we are all taught to think that Black people who are successful are an exception. And I want us to recognize that as part of the violence of American culture, so that no matter how many examples of successful Black people you have in your face, somehow they never seem to be the norm. That's not an accident. Another way to think of it, and this goes along with what I do in the book, another way to think of it is, Black families that conform to what the nation says it respects, right? The heteronormative nuclear family, in which Black men are the head of household, Black women are subordinate, and they have these children. That idea should not make you more worthy of citizenship, but American culture says it does, right? But no matter how many examples of Black families that conform to that ideal, you still have nothing but constant representations of Black families as anything but that. I want us to understand, and this is such an important thing, Henry, I'm so glad you brought it up. Mm-hmm. I want us to understand the way that American culture constantly erases how common those typical Black families are. I want us to understand that erasure as part of the violence of American culture. And of course, it goes hand in hand with the opposite, right? That no matter how many many examples of white families you have that do not conform to what the country says it most respects. They still are conceived of as, you know, the best examples of, you know, what American culture respects. So I don't want us to ignore the work that's being done by our most common words and deeds as Americans, that Black people always need to be in the position of proving themselves, proving their worthiness, proving that they're contributing to society, and white people are assumed to be contributing to society even when there's evidence to the contrary. That is part of the violence that is baked in to how American society works and to our conceptions of American citizenship.
Does that get to your point, Henry?
Yes, it did. And thank you, Professor. Go Bucks.
Go Bucks. Okay. Henry, thanks a lot for the call and thanks for listening. I want to get back to the point you've made several times and kind of drill down into it a little bit as far as the community conversation or debate that's been ongoing and how it plays into this dynamic. A lot of it made me think about a lot of things, and it made me think about like the conversation that a lot of us have been talking about Black parents have with their sons these days, and something that white America really didn't know much about until the last few years when it And about these conversations, it feels like maybe there's, I don't want to call it a secret conversation, but it's something that the country hasn't been involved in. This is distinctly an African-American community conversation that's been ongoing. And when you say that, and when you're talking to people, other Black Americans, African-Americans, do they immediately nod and go, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about, like they do about the conversation with sons?
Well, that's such a great way to put that, because I think it gets back to something else that you had picked up on from the book, which is that it's not an automatic thing for African Americans. It really has to be developed within the conversation, and there's always disagreement. So in other words, just because I'm Black doesn't mean that I don't believe the lies with which this country has bombarded me. So the country has bombarded me with the idea that if I just live up to these standards, I will be safe. If I just live up to these standards, I will be respected. And the truth is, everything about our past and present shows that that's not true, but I'm still being bombarded with that lie. So the reason why I say homemade citizenship actually doesn't exist unless you acknowledge that your success beckons violence is that it takes that debate to understand, because there are Black people who do believe, no, if I'm just perfect, if I'm stopped by the police and I just, you know, behave respectfully, I'll be fine. There are some Black people who believe that. And the only way to get to a different place about that is through that conversation that acknowledges the injustice that is baked into how our society works.
And that's not automatic. That's something everyone has to work at. It's not happening organically. Necessarily.
Yes, because part of what's important about the way that you've introduced me, right, is that I'm a literary historian and cultural critic, which means that part of what I study is discourse and practice, words and deeds. What are the most common words and deeds that define how our culture works? And so it is only by having those conversations, and importantly, having those conversations in a way that acknowledges the power dynamics that determine what our most common words and deeds are. Unless you understand dominant culture as bombarding me with a lie, then you can't understand what's actually operating as a force on both white and Black people and everybody in between.
There's a word you use a lot in your writing, and I want to ask you about it because I'm wondering if you notice it and if you think and if there's any relevance, and if there's not, just shut me down. But it's the word it's the word discursive.
Yeah.
Discursiveness. And I actually looked it up to make sure. And it's sort of like a non sequitur path of action. It doesn't respond logically to something. It's discursive, right?
Oh, that's good. I mean, because there are, at, like all language, it's multifaceted, right? It can mean in so many different ways. You're right. It is an important word for me. And part of the way it becomes so important is because since I study violence, as you mentioned, Living with Lynching was my first book, violence is fundamentally what I study, because what I understand about violence is that violence defines who belongs and who does not. Violence, whenever you can be vulnerable to violence, is because that someone wants to make you understand how much you don't belong. And then when the reaction to the violence against you is to find a way to blame you for it, which is what happens for African Americans. I mean, Casey Woodson Jr. right now here in Columbus, Ohio, is an example of that. We watch how people find ways to blame him. So what's important for us then, for me, is to understand how violence is both physical and discursive. That when our most common words and deeds are to blame the victim, we have to understand the way that you can talk about me is also a form of violence. Because the way you can talk about me and make me always a criminal and always blameworthy is part of what will determine what you can do to me without having any accountability. So that's one way that discursive violence, that the word discursive is important. But what you were saying about the circuitous part of what's important about that is exactly what I just said about how it enables other things to happen. So one of the things that you also know about me is how important studying violence against LGBTQ communities is to me. And so part of what brings me to that work is understanding how much the way that we can talk about people or represent people makes the pathway. So none of us are off the hook if we're not willing to counter the violent words. If I don't myself go and beat up or kill a trans person, that doesn't make me blameless. If I'm willing to go along with anti-trans sentiment, anti-trans words. So that's the other way that discursive is important for me in exactly the way that you described.
We're going to continue our conversation with Caretha Mitchell, literary historian, cultural critic, and associate professor of English at OSU. Her new book is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African American Culture. It was published in August. You can join the conversation 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the trajectory of African-American achievement, particularly by that of African-American women as homemakers, has attracted so much attack from slave cabins to the White House. My guest is the Ohio State University Associate Professor Caretha Mitchell. She is the author of the 2012 book Living with Lynching, African-American Lynching Plays, Performance, and Citizenship. Her new book is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African-American Culture. Thanks again, Caretha Mitchell, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
I wanted to talk about Michelle Obama. And how she fits into this narrative. She noted at one point early on, I think, I can't remember if it was after the election, maybe before the inauguration or after the inauguration. Anyways, at some point she noted that publicly that enslaved people helped build the White House. And as you noted, the home at the center of the nation's identity, I think you were quoting someone else, that would become her home. And she got a really hard time for that. And I thought it was very appropriate, very interesting, very contextually interesting. And yet she got a rash of crap for that. And what are your thoughts about, I mean, that's just one tiny example, right? Just one.
One of so
Why
many.
Why would that have been an issue for people to have to hear that?
Well, because we're so invested in our lie. The lie of American culture is that you know, you will be accepted if you simply behave yourself in an appropriate way. But the idea of what is appropriate is very specific for African Americans, because African Americans are always supposed to, this is the best way I can put it. When I say common words and deeds, all of us know about the common scenario that happens in our schools, in our workplaces, any scenario in which a white person says something racist. And we all know that the person of color, whether they're Black or someone else, is supposed to diffuse the situation and make sure everybody's comfortable. So the job of people of color or other marginalized group is to make white people or people in dominant categories comfortable. And anytime you do something that isn't about that comfort and having a low standard for them to be comfortable, then you get the backlash. And that is a perfect example, right? When in our schools or workplaces, someone white says something racist and the person of color is supposed to diffuse it, it's partly because we're all supposed to believe that no matter what you do or say as a white person, your good intentions are assumed. Your being a good and decent person is assumed.
And it's enough. And it's enough to be good intended.
Absolutely enough. That is all you need. It doesn't have to be based on the objective standard of your actual behavior. Your actual behavior in that moment is supposed to become a non-issue, and it is the job of the person of color to make it a non-issue. We've all experienced that. And that is what I mean throughout the book in terms of saying that know your place aggression is defining American culture. So in that instance, those people were saying, you better know your place. You're supposed to make us feel comfortable. Don't bring up slavery.
Mm-hmm. It seems, so it sounds ungrateful.
Oh, exactly. And I love that you brought it to that exact issue, right? Is that the way our society is set up is that people of color are supposed to be grateful. If you are not appropriately grateful, then there is a problem. Whereas the success that And any success that you've had as a person of color actually meant that you had to encounter challenges that white people weren't having, but you're still supposed to be grateful. That is the demeanor that American culture demands of people of color, gratitude, as if I didn't earn it. But that is baked into our most common words and deeds as Americans.
And I am, you know, I think I can't remember if I talked to you about when I did a show about the larger culture surrounding The Help, the book, the movie, The Help. But I didn't have the time frame very well in hand at the time. I can tell you that because you quoted Black feminist critic Bell Hooks saying that Michelle Obama's visibility did not inspire like cultural representations, but instead an obsession with a presumably better time, a la The Help. And that book came out a year after President Obama was elected. I mean, a year after then the movie came out lickety split 2 years later. Very interesting, the whole time frame of that.
Yes. And so that to me, oh, I love that you brought this up, right? Because this goes to the heart of what the book is examining. It's examining culture. So here we are with Michelle Obama as woman of the nation's house. And instead of having an explosion of popular culture representations of mocha moms, stay-at-home mothers, instead of that, we get The Help. As you say, 2009, the book comes out, 2011, and then Academy Award nominations and everything, because the most appropriate place for Black womanhood is in a servant role. So here they are pretending to be 1960s maids in 2009 and 2011, and that is what the American people galvanize around. Even if you don't want to talk about The Help, you were faced with it constantly because it was constantly being presented to all of us as if it gave us some kind of insight into what would make us good citizens.
As it was a fairy tale, for one thing. It never happened.
Absolutely.
It just never happened.
Yeah. And no, we didn't have a conversation around that time, but you can rest assured that it was definitely a part of how I understood the know your place aggression toward Michelle Obama. How do we put not only you back in your proper place, but all Black women? Go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, once again, and not to belabor the best intentions thing, but is it that people are thinking cognitively about this and going in that direction because of that trajectory that's throughout our history? Or is it just because we're not good cultural critics ourselves and we don't critique, we don't look closely beyond the intentions?
And see, this is such an important question. I think part of what I'm so invested in is our becoming aware of this, partly because the intentions thing feels kind of close to identity. And part of what I'm so invested in doing in this book is understanding that it's not about identity so much as it's about words and deeds, discourses and practices. And so if we just go along with the dominant discourse and practice, we will do as a nation what we did to Michelle Obama, which is, I don't want to be reminded that Black women are homemakers. That doesn't make any sense. It makes more sense for them to be house slaves or housekeepers, even as they prove to be homemakers in the definition that we say we respect. I'm going to erase that and ignore that because that is the American way. And so for me, it's an examination about the most common words and deeds, because it is the assumption that white people have the best intentions, and that is undergirding everything, that their intentions actually don't even have to come into play. So that's the reason why intentions, you know, it's about impact for me more than intention, because their intentions don't come into play when they're just going along with dominant discourse and practice. So for me, raising the bar would require that people actually hold themselves to objective standards instead of the idea that I'm a white person, and so there's no reason for me to think that I'm anything but good and decent. And that would require, as a culture, that we start actually bringing objective standards into being. I mean, this is the way I put it to my students, is if you say that being American is about believing in fair play and equal opportunity, then shouldn't you care that there's not fair play and equal opportunity? And shouldn't that mobilize you to want to do something different? And the fact that it doesn't is where we need to go.
And that's where you're talking about that bystander role. It's that's part of the violence, is being a bystander to it. Saying, well, yeah, of course I want things to be fair, and not doing anything about it.
Oh my goodness, yes. And so to make this concrete, I love that you put it in terms of bystander. To make this concrete, if white people held themselves to a higher standard, then as soon as Donald Trump called Mexicans rapists, they would mobilize and say, this isn't the American way. As soon as he made fun of the reporter with disabilities, they would mobilize and say, this isn't the American way. As soon as they were anti-LGBTQ, but because they're not invested, American culture is structured to make sure that white people never are invested in holding themselves to a higher standard. They just get to be good and decent no matter what they do or don't do. That creates the violence of the bystander, as you're describing it.
We only have like a minute left, Caritha.
Oh, goodness.
I know, but I wanted to ask about your expectations and how all of this, and again, we're very short on time, but will apply to Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. This is a whole nother thing.
Oh my goodness. I mean, part of what's important about Kamala Harris for me is that she will have us see how Know Your Place aggression isn't just about African Americans. Her identity in terms of having South Asian descent is also part of what is bringing people out of the woodwork to be anti her, right? And the fact that she has a blended family will be another opportunity for people to be anti. And so I just want us to pay attention to, how are we defining who belongs and who doesn't? And do you really want it to be about something as arbitrary as not as having a blended family, or as not being white? And do you really want that to be how you define belonging as an American? And we need to think critically about the standards we're using and not using. And I think she will, for better or worse, give us lots of opportunities to really think about how are we defining who belongs and who does not.
Caritha Mitchell, a literary historian, cultural critic, associate professor of English at OSU. Her new book is titled From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African-American Culture. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
All Sides staff, thank you as well. Producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matt Rand, our assistant producer Bobby Gerberich, video production by Nick Payne, and board operation by Herb Howenstein and Scott Good. Thanks to all of you, and thanks for listening. All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.